Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. Shopping at a farmer's market can be fun on a lot of levels. It can be a social outing, a great venue for delicious food, music, and entertainment. And most importantly, it's a way to get your hands on fresh, delicious Iowa-grown food. Coming up in a few minutes, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron will be here, along with Forester Mark Vitosh from the Department of Natural Resources, to answer your questions about the plants and trees in your life. But first, we're going to find out how to get the most out of your visit to the farmer's market with Linda Nabe, Iowa State University Extension Value-Added Agriculture Specialist. Hello, Linda.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about this.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for being here. And Linda, I know that you've been working with farmers markets, tracking farmers markets for a long time. How have you seen the farmers market scene grow in Iowa?
The farmers market scene has really grown and taken off in Iowa, and I think people are really embracing it. You know, they're an integral part of our urban farm link, and they just continue to rise in popularity. According to the USDA, there are about 8,600 farmers markets listed for Iowa.
Wow.
And the Iowa, nationally.
Okay, I was like, what?
In Iowa, it's quite a bit less than that. But
right,
our
cool.
Iowa agriculture .gov, yeah, still a lot. IowaAg.gov, which is our Iowa Department of Ag and Land Stewardship website, has a directory for farmers markets that you can go in and find the farmers market that's been registered with them closest to you. And it gives the location, the dates it opens, the dates it closes, as well as the times that they're open for operation. Many of them also list a website that you can go to get more information if you're interested in being a vendor or other aspects of farmers markets. So that's a great source. But yeah, 8,600 nationally. Take a gander at where you think Iowa falls nationally, Charity, in number of farmers markets per capita.
Oh, per capita.
Where do
oh
we rank
gosh.
Out of the 50 states? 51 counting D.C.
All right. We've got to be top three.
We're fifth. You're very, very close.
Close.
Top is Vermont. North Dakota is two. Now, we're talking not number of farmers markets, but farmers markets per capita. That's per population. Wyoming is fourth. Third. D.C. is fourth, and we are fifth.
Wow.
So it's not quite the order that you might have put the states in, but we are fifth, which means we're doing very well in recognizing our farmers and getting out and patronizing our farmers at the farmers markets. Nationally, too, there is a National Farmers Market Week. Did you know that?
I did not.
Yes, it's the first full week in August that they recognize farmers markets as being important to the local flavor, the rural economy, and it plays a key role in helping low-income women, infants, children, and seniors participate in many programs because they farmers markets do take and accept their programs. So,
right.
You know, it's a great opportunity for everyone, and so National Farmers Markets Week this year, it'll be the 13th through the 19th.
And, you know, Linda, there, as I mentioned before, there are a lot of different ways to enjoy farmers markets. I think some people do go mostly for the entertainment value and, you know, the food trucks are set up outside and maybe there's somebody playing music or doing something cool. And it's a really fun experience. But then there are also the people who maybe they go every week because that's how they stock their fresh produce for the week. So let's talk about that kind of shopper. If you're looking for fresh produce, obviously it changes from week to week. It changes from month to month. And depending on the vendors that you have at your farmer's market, it's going to be different from farmer's market to farmer's market too, right?
That's right. It is. It's very localized because some demographics in a community prefer certain vegetables, and so the farmers are keying in on that and growing and selling that particular crop. For example, okra in some population areas, or some of the Mizuna greens and other things that may be popular in some demographics, not so much in others. So it does vary if you were to travel around the state to see what's offered at the different farmers market. And as you mentioned, it's very important to understand that farmers markets are should be very seasonal. For example, early in the spring, we're going to see green onions, radishes, lettuce, maybe some kohlrabi, then it comes the cabbage, the broccoli, cauliflower, etc. And then as we get into the summer is when we should be seeing melons, cucumbers, tomatoes, peppers, things like that. So our true farmers markets are those that sell the seasonal things that were produced within the state of Iowa or nearby if you're on the corners of the state.
Now, of course, some people work really hard to stretch those seasons. We've talked about high tunnels on the show before, so they want to get their tomatoes to the market earlier or, you know, keep their lettuce mm-hmm. going longer, that kind of thing. When you're at the farmer's market, I mean, sometimes you see, okay, it's pretty early in the season, but you see somebody with a whole lot of tomatoes. How do you know that they're local? How do you decide who to buy from?
The nice thing about that is typically the farmer is the one who's selling the product or someone the farmer hired. The product came directly off the farm. And like you mentioned, there are ways in which farmers are using to extend the season, like high tunnels. So we may see before, let's say we have a backyard tomato plant and ours aren't anywhere close to being ready, but yet you see the tomatoes at the farmer's market. High tunnels do allow growers 4, sometimes even 6 weeks before the outdoor tomatoes are ready and or peppers. So ask the farmer, say, oh, how did you get tomatoes so early? Question them, because that is the beauty of the farmer's market is you have the direct contact with the individual who grew your food. You can ask them the kind of practices they use, what varieties they grow in case you want to grow something like that in your own backyard. The heirlooms, a little history of the heirlooms. Farmers are very up on what they are growing and a little of the history behind it. Learn more about them and their family, where they come from. That's what makes the farmer's market so fun.
Now, a lot of stands at a farmer's market will have a sign that kind of gives you information about how the produce there is grown. But one of the distinctions that I think is interesting, you know, when you go to the grocery store, let's say you're looking for organic food, you know, it's very clearly labeled organic. But at the farmer's market, there's kind of a gray area there where, you know, there's somebody who says that they're organic. There's somebody who puts up a sign that says no spray. There's another, you know, where things are conventionally grown. Why is there so much gray area there?
Well, it's because of the consumers are asking for it. I say the organic people will tell you because they put a lot of extra effort and finances in to be called and considered and certified as certified Iowa certified organic. They will have the logo, certified organic logo, probably posted in their booth. They will definitely say organic because they've earned that right to do that. Now, you'll run into others, and it's no problem, that say pesticide-free. That means they're not using synthetic pesticides, such as insecticides and fungicides, on their crops.
But they're not necessarily officially
certified. They are not certified organic, no. If they say pesticide-free, that does not mean they're certified organic unless they say certified organic and they can show the logo, the label for certified organic.
Okay, so again, it's just a matter of asking questions so you know what you're getting. How about some advice? I try to remember my reusable bags when I go to the farmer's market, but what are your favorite things to have along with you that make it work best for you?
Well, since sometimes when I'm not going to be going, if I go to the farmer's market, I'm not going right home, and it is always hot, and it seems to be getting hotter every Saturday, have a cooler in your car ready to place your product in that cooler, and in the cooler have one of the freezer packs. Don't lay some of the sensitive crops right on the freezer pack, though, but keep them in your reusable grocery bags. But have a cooler available so you can put your product right in the bag so that it helps retain that freshness. You sought it out. You looked for the freshest ones on the farmer's market stand. You don't want it wilted and in bad shape by the time you get home. So have a cooler available, even if your drive is only a half an hour. The back of your vehicle will get warmed up. Your product may start to deteriorate. It won't rot, but it may soften. Leafy crops may wilt. Your herbs may wilt. So have something prepared there. You may even, if the herbs were in a glass, in water at the farmer's market stand, have some water, a small bucket of water available if you intend to buy herbs at the farmer's markets.
All right. So bring something cooler, or a cooler, or one of those insulated bags, that kind of thing. How about making a plan? I think a lot of us get excited at the farmer's market and buy things we weren't necessarily intending to buy.
But there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, those flower vendors are just that impulsive shopping is good with the flower vendors and other things. But yeah, have a plan. First of all, have your list, what you want to buy. Go from that. Have quantities available. Make sure you're aware of whether they sell by the pound or they sell by the piece. It's totally different. Many markets kind of watch each other and market it the same way, but not always. So if you're looking for the best value, check to see that they're, if you're wanting to buy it by the pound or by the piece. And also look at quantities that they sell. They may have a volume discount. Let's say you're going to be canning tomato sauce or pizza sauce or something, and you want some of their seconds. They will likely have some of those for you later in the season for tomatoes, and they'll give a discounted price on that for volume and for seconds.
And I know food safety is one of your specialties as well. Are there any special concerns that we should have?
Yes, mostly for your own safety. Again, keep your food, keep it in a clean bag, a reusable reusable grocery bag if you go to the market. Don't handle all the product, and that's for the safety of yourself and others. Point to the ones you want, and then the vendor themselves will bag it up or put it on the scale for you. The minimal handling by the customers, the better, especially when it comes to some of the fruits and vegetables that we eat raw. That's very important. Another thing, and I'm an animal lover. Don't get me wrong, Charity. I love dogs. But there's a place for everything. And the farmer's market, unless it's a service animal, is not the place for dogs, primarily from a food safety standpoint and a safety standpoint from the other customers at the market.
Right. They can get really, really crowded.
It can get really crowded. And then the leash trips people. The dogs find something on the ground. You never know when And even if the children are face-to-face with the animals, I just think that there's a time and a place, and it's not a good place to have a dog, unless, of course, it is a service animal and it's necessary.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Linda Nave, Iowa State University Extension Value-Added Agriculture Specialist, joining us in just a moment. Richard Giron from ISU Extension Horticulture, and also Mark Vitosh from the Department of Natural Resources. They'll answer your questions at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. The number to call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Linda Nave, Iowa State University Extension Value-Added Agriculture Specialist, is here. Also, Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And Mark Vitosh is here, DNR District Forester. Hello, Mark.
Good morning.
And Mark, I see a lot of brown trees out there. The Japanese beetle has really, really taken a toll this year.
I think Donald hit that really hard last week, though, right? But yes, especially the lindens. We're seeing it on crabapple, even a little bit on oak. Birch, I mean, you name it, a lot of the fruit trees, it's tough, and especially if you get down in the southern part of the state where it's been drier, you worry about stress. I would say if people have smaller trees that are being damaged and they can get a little water to them if they are in a dry situation, that'll help. But other than that, as Donald hit, I think, everything on the head last week, the only thing I would say is, you know, I hear that it won't hurt the trees, but as a tree person, I would say if we see it year after year, you may want to look at alternatives and stuff, because at some point, if you had it 3 or 4 years in a row, that's heavy defoliation. Those trees could then start to succumb to other problems. But fortunately, at least I've been in this area for 17 years, it's really gone in cycles.
Right.
And hopefully we'll
cycle
maybe
out
only
next
hit it,
year.
We'll cycle out next year or the next year, and that's the way it's kind of been. And I remember when this first came, that's the folks from the east and stuff were kind of saying, well, it kind of comes in cycles. So hopefully we stay to that pattern, and trees will get damaged, and trees are very they can handle some defoliation, but if it happens year after year after year, at some point you could start to see some issues.
Absolutely.
But we'll look at that when as time comes.
Well, and it's been dry this week. We've had some decent rain. Richard, how are we feeling about the moisture situation?
It's been very spotty. Last night in Ames, we had around 1.5 to 2 inches of rain, so it was very, very needed. And so some areas have gotten some rain. Northeast Iowa, too much rain. So it's very, very spotty. Some areas are very, very dry still. So.
Well, and when it gets really dry, when you get the 1.5 to 2 inches of rain all in a hurry, is that soaking in or is that
I think most of it
off?
Did soak in. It was so dry, I think most of it did. So I didn't see too much runoff as far as from lawns or our field. So I think most of it did soak in.
All right. And of course, we've also had tremendous heat this week. So that makes some changes in the yard and the garden as well. What kinds of changes do we see when it gets this hot?
It's not so much the heat. It's really the moisture, really. Most plants can tolerate the heat if they have moisture. But if you have the two together, both dry conditions and heat, that's the worst scenario. So when it's very hot, if you can provide some moisture, the plants should be okay.
All right, 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Irvin is on the line in Oskaloosa. Hi, Irvin.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Morning. I've got a big tree in the back of my yard, and I've found one variety of grass back there that's growing really nice in there until it got really, really dry. And I stopped mowing it, and I just went ahead and let that go to seed. It's a nice, fine grass. And it's got a tall single stem and it just full of seed. I was told that maybe I should not do that, leave it go, or am I doing the right thing? Should I mow it or should I not mow it?
I'd be inclined to mow it, but mow it fairly high. And I say that because most of that seed will probably not germinate anyway because the environmental conditions will not be favorable. It's probably some type of fine leaf fescue. And you have things
okay.
Like creeping red fescue, chewings fescue, hard fescue. Now, creeping fescue does spread by itself. It spreads very nicely. So by mowing it, you'll probably encourage it to spread rather than going to seed. So I would typically keep it mowed. Fairly high, but keep it mowed.
Yeah, I mow my yard at least 3 or 3.5 inches anyway. So
yeah, 3 inches is good.
Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot, Irvin. And we'll talk about this a lot in the coming weeks. But, Richard, if you want to reseed, that's coming up.
That's coming up.
But not yet.
Not yet. A little bit early yet. Typically, I would shoot for mid to late August as far as reseeding.
All right. Are we seeing lawns going dormant right now?
Absolutely. Here in central Iowa, yes. Ames, Des Moines, Boone, definitely yes, where the grasses turn brown. Now, when it goes brown, the actual leaf blades have died, but the roots and the crown are still alive. It's simply resting or dormant, and it can stay in that condition for 4, 5, 6 weeks without any significant damage. So it's perfectly normal, but you'd like to see it rain. And when it does turn brown and it does rain, it may be a couple weeks before it greens back up.
All right. So if it goes dormant and it kind of gets brown, I mean, some people water to mm-hmm. keep it green, but if you decide to let it go dormant and stay dormant, then you don't have to mow, right?
Right, you don't. I haven't for quite some time. So
nice. I think that's a lovely break. So do you recommend that people just allow it to go dormant?
It's their decision. If they want a green lawn, then they should water each week. And we typically recommend 1 inch of water per week. They should do that in one application or maybe 1/2 inch every 3 to 4 days, but not every day or every other day. Do it well when you do it, and put on like 1 inch of water per week.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Dale is on the line at 866-780-9100 in Van Meter. Hi, Dale.
Yes, I planted 2 acres of wildflowers and native grasses 2 years ago, and I was wondering what the best time, of course it has some weeds now, to mow or burn it.
It's how old, 2 years old?
2 years old.
Okay.
Yes.
I don't think you have to mow it at this point. You could burn it. Typically, that's done in the spring of the year. But normally when you start to establish something like that, you might mow it the first year or two, but then after that you don't typically. But you can burn
it. I mowed it this last fall and then burned it off this spring. And now the flowers have taken real well, and some of the grasses. Of course, I've got weeds, but...
It sounds like you're making great progress, Dale. That's wonderful.
Well, kind of. Is it burning the fall for the grasses or burning the spring for the flowers, or does it just normally burn in the spring?
Normally, you'd burn in the spring of the year.
Although some people do fall burns.
But Dale, I would suggest it. Even if this isn't in a government program or anything, that you contact your local either county conservation board, natural resource person, or your natural resource conservation service folks at the farm service and see if you can just get somebody some time to take a look to see your weed population, to see how things are growing, and maybe just give you some general recommendations on your particular situation when the best time would be to burn. Or, because like Richard said, usually mowing is critical the very first year and sometimes early the second season. But after that, usually mowing isn't needed unless you're spot mowing for particular weeds and stuff. But I would consider contacting a local natural resource person just to see if you can get them to do a drive-by or take a look, see where you're at, and then give you specific recommendations on your particular plot.
All right, Dale, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me this hour, I've got Mark Vitosh, DNR District Forester, Richard Geron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, and Linda Nabe, Iowa State University Extension Value-Added Agriculture Specialist. And Ralph's up next in Grinnell. Hi, Ralph.
First question I didn't ask is if I was going to plant plum trees next spring on some pasture that I'm going to turn to CRP, is it kind of up to me on what kind of plums to plant, whether it's a green gauge or dark purple or whatever else? And is there any diseases that will bother those? And then the second question is the walnut trees are losing a fair amount of walnuts. Is that typical?
You can start with the plum, Richard, and I'll follow up with the black walnut.
Okay, you're planting these for to basically eat?
Farmer's market,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there's two types that you could plant. You have the European-type plums. They're self-fertile or self-fruitful, and so you can plant just one variety and you'll get fruit. You can also plant the hybrid plums. Those typically require two different cultivars or varieties for cross-pollination. As far as the site, basically they need a well-drained, fertile soil. They do not do well in poorly drained wet sites, so it needs to be a well-drained soil. In wet soils, they tend to get a root rot, so it should be a well-drained, fertile soil.
Okay.
And I would recommend protecting them from wildlife the first few years.
Definitely.
Put some chicken wire around them. And
chicken wire, hardware, cloth, something of that nature, yes, definitely.
Because there's a lot of deer in the area.
Yep. All right.
So have you planted green gauge plums?
Oh, sorry.
Have you planted green gauge plums before? I had a tree that was about 20 years old and didn't come back to life this spring. I don't know whether.
Well, green gauge might be a little bit iffy as far as hardiness. You have Damson, Mount Royal. Those are the purple type. Those are European plums. And then you have the hybrids like Superior, Toka.
It sounds like a lot of choices. All right, so let's move on to the walnut question. Walnuts dropping early, is this something you're seeing, Mark?
Actually, it is. I have to maneuver around them on my bike trail in the mornings. but we, at least in eastern Iowa, we had a pretty good start, pretty good crop, quite a few. But I've seen reports and have heard and talked to people, especially in areas if you have trees that are stressed, if you've had some drought stress or anything like that, a lot of times they will drop early for whatever reason, usually weather-related. And we see that every year to different degrees. So you may be in an area that for whatever reason there's some stress in those plants, or maybe they had a really heavy crop. Sometimes they will thin themselves too.
Right. So not necessarily anything to be concerned about.
No, but the one thing we may be seeing too this year, depending again on your location and stuff, especially in some of the northern areas, There is a disease called anthracnose that causes early defoliation, so you may be seeing some early defoliation, some yellowing of the leaves and some of that too. We see a little bit of that, especially in wet years, just like we see a lot of apple scab on crab apples. I'll add on the plum thing too. If it's in CRP, one of the critical things, and Richard may have said it, and if I didn't hear it, I'm sorry, is weed control is really critical. So either using herbicides or mulch or light cultivation, if you're putting them in strips or in pockets, you want basically a 2 to 3 foot grass-free zone around those plants the first 3 years at a minimum. Any kind of woody plants in CRP grass or whatever, that weed control is really critical to getting good growth, and that'll help you help get it above some of the animals and stuff too.
All right, so almost cultivate them like a row crop, it sounds like.
You do. That's we do a lot of tree plantings and shrub plantings on CRP, and really we try to require 3 years minimum of good weed control, and really in the case of a plant, a woody plant, grass is a weed. So just mowing alone is not really good weed control. You got to eliminate that grass somehow to reduce the competition.
All right, a big challenge. Let's get to our next question at 866-780-9100. Neil is on the line in Cumming. Hi, Neil.
Morning. Hey, a quick question. I was going through the garage and ran across a bag that I bought this spring of Glads that didn't get planted. What would happen if my potatoes are ready to come out, so I've got some open space. What would happen if I put them in the ground this time of year?
All right, gladiolas, huh?
Right. Well, you have to. Otherwise, they're not going to keep until next year.
Okay.
So I would go ahead and plant them. It usually takes about 8 to 10 weeks for them to bloom. So get them in the ground as soon as you can. They may not bloom, but
they may come up faster than they would earlier in the season,
right,
too.
So just keep them well watered. And if they don't bloom, you can actually dig them up in the fall and save them for next year.
Yeah, probably not. But second question is, I have different varieties of hostas. Some are definitely more blighty resistant. What causes the browning on the edges, and what kind of spray or what kind of treatment can I do to stay ahead of that?
I would think the browning is probably due to the dry conditions and the heat or too much sun.
Okay.
Hostas as a group like a moist, well-drained soil. They don't like extremely dry conditions, and when it gets hot and you have dry soil conditions, they tend to bleach or the margins tend to turn brown. So I'm assuming it's probably the weather.
And are some more tolerant? Because I got some side-by-side, and one is looking great, and the other one is looking a little wimpy.
Absolutely. Certain varieties are more sun-tolerant than others, more heat-tolerant than others. So, yes, you can have some that look perfectly fine, and others are badly scorched or brown.
Got it.
All right.
Hey, guys, thanks for your show. You do a great job.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Neil. Next up, we've got Mary Lee in Grundy Center. Hi, Mary Lee.
Good morning. I've been growing some sunflowers for the last few years, and last year they got a rust on the leaves, and it killed the plant. And so this year I'm wondering what I can do to prevent that. I've done some searching online, and everything I found is for sunflower growers, like farmers, and I have maybe 20 or 30 sunflowers. One thing I've been doing is I'm only watering at the base of the plant or on the ground. I'm not letting water get up on the leaves. But is there some type of spray I can put on them to prevent the rust?
I'm not sure exactly what kind of disease it is. And so trying to apply something and control that is very difficult if you're not sure of the actual pathogen. So my suggestion would be, yes, water at the base of the plant. Don't get the foliage wet. And if this reoccurs, have it identified so you know exactly what it is, and you know what to use possibly next year. But just spraying it with a fungicide probably isn't going to work very well.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Here's an email question from Tracy at Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. Every year, I get larger brown flat-topped mushrooms in my lawn, which is very shaded. I pick them out at the roots of the mushroom. New ones appear virtually daily and grow at a spectacular rate. Recently, they've spread into my flower and hosta garden as well. Is there some type of product that I can use to eliminate these mushrooms without hurting animals? I have 3 large dogs that have run of the yard.
A short answer, no.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
So keep picking them.
Right. Basically, if you don't like them, if they're annoying, you have to pick them up. But there's nothing you can apply to the ground that's going to prevent them from coming up in the future. Nothing.
All right. The way you said that, Richard, sounds like a battle you've fought.
So you just live with them.
That's an easy answer, though.
That's true. It's true. All right. We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa, and we are here to answer your questions. 866-780-9100 is our phone number. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Linda Nave, Iowa State University Extension Value-Added Agriculture Specialist, Richard Duran, ISU Extension Horticulture Specialist, and Mark Vitosh, Department of Natural Resources, District Forester. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. We'd love to hear from you with your questions, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Duran. Linda Nave is a Value-Added Agriculture Specialist with ISU Extension. And Mark Vitosh, DNR District Forester, is also here to answer your tree questions. And let's get back to the phones. Bill is on the line in Coralville. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I'm a real novice when it comes to bluegrass lawns, and I'm spot treating the usual weeds like dandelions and clover, crabgrass, but wondering what is the advantage and benefit of doing fall fertilizing? Wouldn't that just be feeding the weeds as well?
Well, actually, you want to fertilize when the grass is or has favorable growing conditions. And Kentucky bluegrass is a cool season grass. So it really thrives during the spring when it's cool and also in the fall. So you typically want to fertilize when the grass has favorable environmental conditions. We typically do not suggest fertilizing in June, July, or August. So you can do it in the spring. That's fine. That's great. You can also do it in September and also in late October, early November. So you can do it once, you can do it twice, you can do it three times, but typically not in June, July, or August.
All right.
Right. And what would be the advantage then of fertilizing in the fall? How would that affect negatively the weeds without just causing the grass to just grow longer?
Well, as far as fertilizing in September, the grass has come through the summer. It's been very hot, very dry typically. And so when you fertilize in September, that helps the grass recover from that stress. Okay? Now, if you fertilize in late October, early November, basically what you're doing is you're fertilizing when the grass has basically stopped growing. And so if you fertilize at that time of year, the grass plant is still alive. It's going to absorb the nutrients, but you're not going to see a lot of leafy growth. And basically what the plants are going to do is they're going to take those nutrients and store them in the plant. So next spring, you get really nice green up early in the spring.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Bill. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Farouk is on the line next in Mason City. Hi, Farouk.
Hello, Charity. How are you?
Great. Nice to talk to you. And you, you've been battling Japanese beetles?
Yes, I have. And I was reading up on it, and I found out a product called, neem oil is what I found, that'll battle the Japanese beetle. But I found a place in Iowa. There's a bunch of places in Iowa and Minnesota where you can buy neem oil for very cheap. The Indian grocery stores that sell, like, you know, different curry powders and stuff like that, they carry neem oil and neem products for cooking as well. So or not for cooking, but for washing and so on and so forth. So that's a good place to go find neem oil for very cheap, because they bring it in bottles in bulk. And so I've tried it where you go ahead and put neem oil and mix up with some water and so on, and then you just spray it, and it keeps the beetles away.
Nice. Well,
basically what the neem does, it doesn't actually kill the insect. It makes them less likely to feed on the plant. So it doesn't actually kill them, but it may deter feeding. So
if you have something you want to protect, it might be.
Right, you might try that.
It's
right. But I would prefer a product specifically for garden use, so you know exactly how to use it.
All right. But Farouk, thank you so much for the suggestion. Next up, Millie in Wesley. Hi, Millie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two questions, if I may. The first one, dehumidifier water, can that be used for watering plants in the wintertime? Is that got as many nutrients as rainwater?
It's basically just water. Absolutely. You can use it.
Mm-hmm. Good. And the other thing is, what do I plant on the south side of the house? The roof has got a large overhang, and it's very dry, and it's in the shade.
Boy, that's going to be difficult.
The difficult thing is the very dry.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying it never gets any moisture at all?
Very, very little.
Very little. Okay. I guess I would maybe try something like creeping lily turf, which is a grass-like plant. It's very, very tolerant, very adaptable, and I would probably mulch around the plants and let it fill in. It's a grass-like plant. It grows about 8 inches tall. It's a very, very tough, very adaptable plant.
And now there might be sedums. Some sedums might be tolerant to that area as well. The stony crop sedums and some of the lower-growing sedums that are tolerant to heat and dry conditions.
Okay.
All right. Well, good luck with that, Millie. Thanks a lot for your call. We've got a couple of tree questions next for you, Mark. Lou is up next in North Liberty. Hi, Lou.
Hey there. Hi. Hey, Cherry.
Hi.
Yeah, this is for Mark. I have some poplar that have a borer, and we're going to try to root drench a compound called Thymet. And I was wondering if you've had any experience, inoculating roots with compounds.
Well, they're depending on the label, depending on the chemical. If you root drench, it will uptake. The thing I'll tell you is if you have borers on poplars, and if these are poplars that are starting to get older, most poplars, their lifespan is probably somewhere between 15 and 35 years. And if you're starting to get borers, usually that means that tree is becoming stressed, and you're going to continue to see that. As long as it's on the, I don't know that particular chemical right off the top of my brain, but if it's on the label for that particular use, then you can use it. But the challenge that you have, usually most of these borers are secondary. So they're coming into a tree that's already starting to decline, is already becoming stressed. So with a poplar, there's a good chance that tree's going to continue to decline on you anyway.
Yep.
How old is it?
A couple places, 7-8 years old, you can really see a difference in soils.
Okay.
There's your stress, and you can see the invasion difference due to that stress.
Right.
And I thought we should try something, and I was just curious if we coppice the tree back, which we do, we could put maybe some kind of a retardant for invasion again. But I've never used it before. I thought you might have. Perhaps.
Well, I haven't used that particular. But again, I would look at the label and see if it's used for if the label says for use of borers on trees, sure. then you can legally use that. But again, if you're seeing a difference in the soils. Poplars like good moisture, and if it's drier in some of those areas or maybe it's harder or something like that, then that may be why those trees. And so for me, you're kind of up against a wall here. I would strongly consider maybe not using that chemical, let those trees die and use some other plant that's going to be more adaptable to that than trying to continue to keep something out that's going to keep coming at you on those particular trees.
Sure. Okay, good idea.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Lou. Another tree question. This one's from John in Indianola. Hi, John.
Good morning, Charity.
What's your question?
Yeah, my question is, we recently purchased a home with a large, older sycamore tree in the front yard. And I did look online a little bit about the shedding of bark, but I wanted to know, this is probably 100 feet tall. Is this something that happens year-round? Are there certain times of the year when it sheds more of the bark? Does it relate to moisture? Anything you can do to sort of, explain the shedding of bark on a sycamore tree?
It's usually as they get some pretty good growth, and it seems like the last couple years, if it's a drier situation, especially over the last couple weeks, I walk in the mornings too, and it's been quite hazardous on the sidewalk some mornings.
I agree, yes.
Yes, and so I really think it is weather related, and I think it's probably growth related. That this time of year they're growing pretty well. But it seems like when we have some warmer conditions, I see a lot more of that sloughing. And really, that is sycamore. That's what they do as they grow. They get a lot of that. But just from an observation, boy, this last couple of weeks, I have really mm-hmm. noticed a lot. But those temperatures have been really high, too. So I think there's some weather relation there. It's one of those things that you're going to have to get used to. It's kind of like the same thing. This year, the sycamores looked, in a lot of areas, looked really poor with anthracnose because of that early moisture that we had. But usually by the 4th of July or a couple weeks later, a lot of times you can't tell that they hardly had any leaves in the springtime. And that's why sycamore gets that kind of messy tag. But I always say as humans, some of us are kind of messy too, and we put up with us. So it's one of those things, you think about all the benefits that a huge tree like that can provide and that winter beauty of that bark too. So it's just one of those things you're going to have to deal with. Sorry.
All right, John. Thanks a lot for your call. Tam is up next in Cedar Falls. Hi, Tam.
Hello?
Yeah, what's your question? Can you hear us?
Hello?
Yes, what's your question? Let's go to Tawny on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Tawny.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, I have had grapevines for the past several years. They're beautiful vines, but no grapes.
But no grapes.
No grapes.
Okay. Do you prune them in the spring?
No, I prune them in the winter or fall, late fall.
Okay. And do you prune them back severely? Okay. Now, the grapevine produces fruit on last year's growth. So when you prune them, you have to leave a certain amount of last year's growth. If you prune it all off, they are not going to bear fruit. So we typically suggest you want to keep maybe 40 to 50 to 60 buds on last year's growth to produce the fruit. Do not remove all of last year's growth. That's the important thing.
Oh, okay. All right. Very good. I'll try that.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Tawny and
Richard,
Kevin.
I'm going to interrupt here. Richard, do you recommend, though, that she prune in the spring or
absolutely.
Later rather than the fall?
Early spring, typically March, early April before it leaves out. And again, keep in mind that they produce fruit on last year's growth, and you want to leave 40 to 60 buds of on that growth.
All right. Kevin's up next in Des Moines. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. I have an arborvitae. It's about 5 foot. It's in an outdoor planter. It's been there for a couple of years. It's survived the past two winters. And this spring, it had a lot of nice, bright green new growth on it. About a month ago, I noticed at the top, it was kind of brown out. And I thought it was a reflection off a window. I might have done that. But now the entire arborvitae is browning. All the new growth is browned, is dead, you know. I was wondering what you think might be going on. Is it possible to overwater that arborvitae?
Well, it is, but I would assume maybe some neglect possibly where maybe it wasn't watered at some point. It's growing in a small amount of potting soil or soil, and if neglected because of the heat, if it got dry, I could see where it might very quickly die. So it might be that issue more than anything else.
And if it's a smaller pot, eventually it could start to become root-bound a little bit too, depending on the size of the pot and stuff. And so sometimes that can cause some plant stress. One thing you may want to do is just stick your – if you're watering, is try to probe down into the pot and make sure that the pot has good drainage and stuff so that it's not – so water's not sitting in the bottom and that it drains out well, because that could cause some root issues too. Because typically
I've always kept the water by it. I've always kept the water well, but I didn't think I could overwater it.
That's definitely a possibility. Overwatering, even with Arborvita, they're pretty tolerant to a lot of different conditions. But if it stayed pretty moist in the bottom on a regular basis, that could cause some issues.
All right. Well, good luck with that, Kevin. Thanks a lot for your call. Tam is back on the line in Cedar Falls. Hi, Tam.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. This is the first year I've acquired the single or solo bulb garlic. It is delicious. I planted it. It produced the scape, and the top of the scapes have the little bulbils on it. I'd like to know when to harvest those bulbils, how to plant them, and then do you have any reference material that you could direct me to for information about the solo bulb garlic specifically?
Not specifically, no, but I would probably take those little bulblets from the top, and I would probably plant them this fall, like in October, and I would cover them with several inches of straw so they have some winter protection, and then remove that straw next spring when you start to see foliage emerging from the ground. So I would harvest them and then go ahead and plant them in October.
All right. Well, Tam, thanks a lot for your call. Let's get a few email questions in here. This one is from Jane. She says, can I still plant parsnips for spring harvest?
You can. Yes. It's hard to get good germination in midsummer, but you can definitely try, yes. And you may need to water if you're not getting any rain to basically get some germination of seed.
All right. And she also says, my green beans have been inundated with what I think are aphids, small green flying bugs. How can I control this problem?
Probably not aphids, because they typically don't fly. So I'm not sure what they are. Now, if you don't really see any damage on the plants, I wouldn't worry about them.
All right.
But if they do, it could be a bean beetle, small bean beetle. So,
but you would see holes in the foliage if they're doing that. And if you're seeing a lot of holes, you may need to control them. Just a few, I wouldn't bother.
All right. Here's one from Peggy in Cedar Rapids. Is it too late to plant a hydrangea bush?
No, it's not. Make sure that if you do it now that you keep it well watered. That's important. And keep on doing that into fall and into possibly early December.
All right. She's also worried about her maple tree because there weren't any helicopter seeds this year on her maple tree. Is that a concern?
Not to me.
It wouldn't be to me either.
I would really look at the growth of the plant. Again, it could be weather related that she didn't have any helicopters. But I would look at the new growth on the plant, and if she's getting 6 to 12 or more inches of growth, then she'll be okay. I really look at the growth.
Sometimes, is that cyclical sometimes?
It can be, yep. And it could be if it was a silver maple, which would be spring, and that's what I'm kind of thinking, is if there was weather and stuff, it just didn't set.
All right. Well, we are out of time. Mark Vitosh, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Have fun on Ragbri.
I will.
DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh. Linda Nave, thank you.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure, Charity.
Iowa State University Extension Value-Added Agriculture Specialist Linda Nave. And Richard Duran, thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh, and we wanted to mention you've got a field day coming up, the Fruit and Vegetable Field Day on August 7th.
Monday at the Horticulture Station. They need to register because it's free, but there's going to have supper.
It's
from 2 to 6:30.
Nice. All right. Thank you very much. We'll be back with Horticulture Day again next Friday. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.